be able to, but the talent is fleeting," said the witch. "I don't know if it's my eyes or if it's the manuscript that's being tricky."
"You always had strong eyes," said her father. "Even as a toddler, you could see things no one else could."
"Ha!" she said. "I don't know what you mean."
"You had a looking-glass that sweet Turtle Heart made for you, and you looked in it as if you could see other worlds, other times."
"I was probably looking at myself."
But they both knew that wasn't true, and Frex for once said so. "You didn't look at yourself," he said. "You hated to. You hated your skin, your sharp features, your strange eyes."
"Where did I learn that hate?" she asked.
"You were born knowing it," he said. "It was a curse. You were born to curse my life."
He patted her hand affectionately, as if he didn't mean much by this.
"When you lost your weird baby teeth and your second teeth came in normally, we all relaxed a little. But for the first couple of years, until Nessa Rose was born, you were a little beast. Only when saintly Nessa Rose was delivered to us, even more scarred than you, did you settle down like a normal child."
"Why was I cursed to be different?" she said. "You are a holy man, you must know."
"You are my fault," he said. Despite his words, he was somehow pinning blame on her instead of himself, though she still wasn't clever enough to see how this was done. "For what I failed to do, you were born to plague me. But don't worry yourself about it now," he added. "That's all long ago."
"And Nessa Rose?" she asked. "How do the weights and balances of shame and guilt account for her?"
"She is a portrait of the lax morals of your mother," Frex said calmly.
"And that's why you could love her so much," said the witch, "because her human frailty wasn't your fault."
"Don't stew so. You always stewed," Frex said. "And now she is dead, so what does it matter?"
"My life is still running on."
"But mine is running out," he answered sadly. So she put his hand back on his lap and kissed him gently and folded up the page of the Grimoire and tucked it in her pocket. Then she turned to greet the person approaching them across the lawn. She thought it was someone with tea. Frex was still accorded a measure of service due to his age and his mildness, and, she supposed, his vocation. But she stood and pressed down the front of her homespun black skirt when she saw who it was.
"Miss Glinda of the Arduenas," she said, her heart churring. "Oh, you came. I knew you would," said Glinda. "Miss Elphaba, the last true eminent Throp, no matter what they say."
Glinda approached slowly, either through age or shyness, or because her ridiculous gown weighed so much that it was hard for her to get up enough steam to stride. She looked like a huge glinderberry bush, was all the witch could think. Under that skirt there must be a bustle the size of the dome of St. Florick's. There were sequins and furbelows and a sort of History of Oz, it seemed, stitched in trapunto in 6 or 7 ovoid panels all around the skirting. But her face, beneath the powdered skin, the wrinkles at eyelid and mouth, was the face of the timid schoolgirl from the Pertha Hills.
"You haven't changed a whit," said Glinda. "Is this your father?"
The witch nodded, but shushed her. Frex had dropped off again.
"Come, we'll walk in the gardens before they root up the roses out of some benighted attempt at eradicating injustice."
The witch took Glinda's arm.
"Glinda, you look hideous in that get-up. I thought you'd have developed some sense by now."
"When in the provinces," she said, "you have to show them a little style. I don't think it's so bad. Or are the satin bells at the shoulder a bit too-too?" "Excessive," agreed the witch. "Someone get the scissors. This is a disaster." They laughed.
"My dear, what they've done to this grand old place," said Glinda. "Look, those pediments are meant to support graven urns, and those revolutionary slogans are painted all over that exquisite belvedere. I hope you'll have something done, Elfie. There isn't a belvedere to match that outside of the capital."
"I never had the love of architecture that you did, Glinda," said the witch. "I just read the slogans. She walked all over us."
"Why shouldn't they paint all over her belvedere, if she did, in fact, walk all over them?"
"Tyrants come and go. Belvederes are forever," said Glinda. "I can recommend top-notch restorers the moment you ask."
"I hear you were one of the first on the scene," said the witch, "when Nesseroes died. How did that come to be?"
"Sir Chuffrey, my hubby, he has some investments in pork futures, you know, and Munchkin Land is trying to diversify its economic base so as not to be at the mercy of Gillikin Banks and the Emerald City Corn Exchange. You never know what relationship might develop between Munchkin Land and the rest of Oz, and it's best to be prepared. So where Sir Chuffrey does business, I do good. It's a partnership made in heaven. You know, I have more money than I can give away."
She giggled and squeezed the witch's arm.
"I never imagined that doing public charity would provide such a rush."
"So you were here in Munchkin Land?"
"Yes, I had been at an orphanage on the shores of Mossmere, and for a lark I thought I'd go to the game park. They have dragons there now. And I'd never seen a dragon, so I was scarcely a dozen miles away when the storm hit. We had terrible winds even there. I cannot imagine how a ceremony could have been in progress in Center Munch. In Mossmere, there were whole sections of the park closed to visitors due to the fear of falling trees and escaping animals."
"Oh, so they call it a game park with animals," said the witch.
"You must go, dear. It's a lark. Well, as I was saying, the house came right out of the blue, and I suppose I mean that literally. If they'd sensed a big storm, they'd surely have cancelled the event and run for cover. Anyway, the news system is very advanced now in parts of Munchkin Land. Nesseroes herself oversaw a system of beacons and tick-tock code signals to warn of invasions from the wizard and points west. So it was only a matter of minutes before the news was being flashed in all directions. I commandeered a mature phoenix and asked her to bring me to Center Munch, and I arrived before most of the locals had quite figured out what had hit them."
"Tell me about it," said the witch.
"You'll be pleased to hear there was no blood. I venture to guess there were massive internal injuries, but there was no blood. Of course, Nesseroes's last few devoted followers thought this meant her spirit was taken up intact, and that she suffered little. I don't imagine she suffered much, not with that kind of clonk on the noggin. Her more unhappy subjects, who were the greater in number, thought it a droll act of Lurlina, releasing them from Nesseroes's particular sort of fundamentalist bondage. There was revelry when I arrived, and much fetting of the funny girl and the dog who seemed to have lived in the house."
"Oh, who's that?" said the witch,
who hadn't heard this part. "Well, you know how Munchkin Landers bow and scrape, no matter what their democratic inclinations. No sooner had I arrived than they deferred to me, introducing me as a witch. I tried to correct them. A sorceress is really much more apt, but never mind. It was no doubt the outfit. It cowed them. I was in a salmon-pink fantasy that day, and really it suited me."
"Go on," said the witch, who had never liked talking about clothes.
"Well, the child introduced herself. Dorothy from Kansas." I didn't know the place, and said as much. She appeared as much surprised as anyone else about what had happened, and she had a nasty little pooch yapping about her heels, Tata or Toto or something. Toto, So this Dorothy was in some state of shock, I can tell you. A fairly homely little girl with little fashion sense, but I suppose that comes later in life for some than others. She glanced sideways at the witch. Much later in some cases. And they both chuckled at that. Dorothy supposed she should try to get back to her home, but as she couldn't remember having studied anything about Oz in school, nor could I recall a place named Kansas, we decided that she should look for help elsewhere. The fickle Munchkinlanders seemed ready to nominate her as Nessie's successor, which would have angered Nip and all those ministers in Colwyn Grounds, who've spent their careers jockeying for position when and if Nessa Rose ever saw fit to die. Besides, there may be other developments afoot. Dorothy might have gotten in the way. An eye to public affairs. Well, somehow I'm not surprised, said the witch. In fact, quite pleased. I always knew you were in there somewhere, Glinda. Well, I thought the better move would be to get Dorothy out of Munchkinland before a civil war tore this place up even worse than it already is. There are factions, you know, who support the reannexation of Munchkinland by Oz. It would do the girl no good to get caught in the crossfire of opposing interests. Oh, so she's not here, said the witch. I had thought I'd meet her. Dorothy? Now, you're not going to take against her, are you? Said Glinda. She's a child, really. Big by Munchkinlander standards, of course, but a squat little thing nonetheless. She's an innocent Elfie. I can see by the gleam in your eye that you're up to your old paranoia thing again. She wasn't piloting that house, you know. She was trapped in it. This would be one struggle you'd do well just to leave alone. The witch sighed. You may be right. You know, I'm getting used to stiff muscles in the morning. Sometimes I think that vengeance is habit-forming, too. A stiffness of the attitude. I keep hoping that the wizard will be toppled in my lifetime, and this aim seems to be at odds with happiness. I suppose I can't take on avenging the death of a sister I didn't get on all that well with anyway. Especially if the death is an accident, Glinda said. Glinda, said the witch, I know you must remember Fiero, and you have heard of his death 15 years ago. Of course, said she. Well, I heard he died under mysterious circumstances. I knew his wife, said the witch, and his in-laws. It was suggested to me once that he had been carrying on an affair with you in the Emerald City. Glinda turned yellow-pink. My dear, she said, I was fond of Fiero, and he was a good man and a fine statesman. But among other things, you will remember he was dark-skinned. Even if I took up dalliances, an inclination I believe rarely benefits anyone, you are once again being suspicious and cranky to suspect me and Fiero. The idea! And the witch realized, sinkingly, that this was, of course, true. The ugly skill at snobbery had returned to Glinda in her middle years. But for her part, Glinda had no real inkling that the witch was implicating herself as Fiero's adulterous lover. Glinda was too fussed to listen that closely. The witch, in fact, alarmed her a little. It was not just the novelty of seeing her again, but the strange charisma Elphaba possessed, which had always put Glinda in the shade. Also there was the thrill, basis indeterminable, which made Glinda shy and caused her to rush her words and to speak in a false high voice like an adolescent. How quickly you could be thrown back to the terrible uncertainty of your youth. For when she chose to remember her youth at all, she could scarcely dredge up an ounce of recollection about that daring meeting with the wizard. She could recall far more clearly how she and Elfie had shared a bed on the road to the Emerald City. How brave that had made her feel, and how vulnerable, too. They walked for a way in a restless silence.
"Things might begin to improve now," said the witch after a time. "I mean, Munchkin Land will be a mess for a while. A tyrant is terrible, but at least he or she imposes order. The anarchy that follows the deposition of a tyrant can be bloodier than before. Still, things may work out all right. Father always said that when left to themselves, the Munchkinlanders had a great deal of common sense. And Nessie was, for all practical purposes, a foreigner. She was raised in Quadling country, and, you know, she may have been half Quadling herself, I've come to realize. She was a foreign queen on this soil, despite her inherited title. With her gone, the Munchkinlanders might just right themselves."
"Bless her soul," said Glinda. "Or do you still not believe in the soul?"
"I can make no comment on the souls of others," said the witch.
They walked some more. Here and there the witch saw, as before, the totemic straw men pinned to tunics and erected like effigies in the corners of fields.
"I find them somewhat creepy," she said to Glinda. "Now, one other thing I want to ask you. I asked this of Nessa once. Do you remember Madame Morrible's corralling us into her parlor and proposing we become three adepts, three high witches of Oz, sort of secret local priestesses shaping public policy behind the scenes, contributing to the stability or instability of Oz as required by some unnamed higher authority?"
"Oh, that farce, that melodrama, how could I forget it?" said Glinda.
"I wonder if we were put under a spell then. Do you remember? She said we couldn't talk about it, and it didn't seem that we could."
"Well, we are talking about it, so if there was any truth to it, which I doubt, it's certainly worn off by now."
"But look what's happened to us. Nessa Rose was the Wicked Witch of the East. You know that's what they called her. Don't pretend to be so shocked. And I have a stronghold in the West, and I seem to have rallied the Arjikis around me by dint of the absence of their ruling family. And there you are, sitting pretty in the North, with your bank accounts and your legendary skills at sorcery."
"Legendary nothing. I simply see to it that I am admired in the right circles," said Glinda.
"Now, my memory is just as good as yours, and Madame Morrible proposed that I be an adept of Gillikin, but that you be an adept of Munchkinland, and Nessa be an adept of Quadling country. The Vincas she didn't think worth bothering about. If she was seeing the future, she got it wrong. She got you and Nessa all wrong."
"Forget the details," said the witch tartly.
"I just mean, Glinda, is it possible we could be living our entire adult lives under someone's spell? How could we tell if we were the pawns of someone's darker game?"
I know, I can see it in your face. Elfie, you're sniffing conspiracy theories again, but you were there. You heard what I heard. How do you know your life hasn't been pulled by the strings of some malign magic?"
"Well, I pray a lot," said Glinda. "Not terribly genuinely, I admit, but I try. I think the unnamed God would have mercy on me, and give me the benefit of the doubt, and release me from a spell if I had accidentally fallen under one. Don't you? Or are you still so atheistic?"
"I have always felt like a pawn," said the witch. "My skin color's been a curse. My missionary parents made me sober and intense. My school days brought me up against political crimes against animals. My love life imploded and my lover died. And if I had any life's work of my own, I haven't found it yet, except in animal husbandry, if you could call it that."
"I'm no pawn," said Glinda. "I take all the credit in the world for my own foolishness. Good gracious, dear, all of life is a spell. You know that.
But you do have some choice."
"Well, I wonder," said the witch. They walked on.
Graffiti was splattered on the sides of the granite plinths of statues. Now the shoes on the other foot. Glinda tisk-tisked.
"Animal husbandry," she said.
They crossed a little bridge. Bluebirds twinkled music above them like a sentimental entertainment.
"I sent this Dorothy, this girl, on to the Emerald City," said Glinda. "I told her I'd never seen the wizard. Well, I had to lie. Don't look at me like that. If I told her the truth about him, she would never have left here. I told her to ask him to send her home. With his reconnaissance spies all over Oz, and no doubt elsewhere, he has heard of Kansas, I'm sure. Nobody else has."
"That was a cruel thing to do," said the witch.
"She's such a harmless child. No one should take her seriously," said Glinda carelessly. "If the Munchkinlanders started rallying around her, reunification might be a more bloody affair than we all hope."
"So you hope for reunification?" muttered the witch, disgusted. "You support it?"
"Besides," Glinda went on blithely, "having some motherly instinct somewhere inside this pushed-up bosom of mine, I gave her Nessa's shoes as a sort of protection."
"You what?" The witch whirled and faced Glinda. For a moment she was dumb with rage, but only for a moment.
"Not only does she come whomping out of the sky and stepping her big clumsy house all over my sister, but she gets the shoes, too? Glinda, those shoes weren't yours to give away. My father made them for her, and furthermore, Nessa promised I could have them when she died."
"Oh, yes," said Glinda in a false calm, surveying the witch up and down.
"And they would make the perfect accessory for that glass-of-fashion outfit you have on. Come on, Elfie, since when have you cared about shoes, of all things? Look at those army boots you have on."
"Whether I'd wear them or not is none of your concern. You can't go handing out a person's effects like that. What right had you? Papa reshaped those shoes from skills he learned from Turtleheart. You've stuck your fancy wand in where it wasn't wanted."
"I'll remind you," said Glinda, "that those shoes were coming apart until I had them resold, and I laced them through with a special binding spell of my own. Neither your father nor you did that much for her. Elfie, I stood by her when you abandoned her in Shiz, as you abandoned me. You did, don't deny it. Stop those lightning bolt looks at me, I won't have it. I became her surrogate sister. And as an old friend, I gave her the power to stand upright by herself through those shoes. And if I made a mistake, I'm sorry, Elfie, but I still feel they were more mine to give away than yours."
"Well, I want them back," said the witch.
"Oh, put it behind you, will you? They're only shoes," said Glinda. "You're behaving as if they're holy relics. They were shoes, and a bit out of style, truth be told. Let the girl have them. She has nothing else."
"Look how the people here thought of them," said the witch. She pointed to a stable on which was scrawled in broad red letters, "Walk all over you, you old witch."
"Please give it a rest," said Glinda. "I have such a headache coming on."
"Where is she?" said the witch. "If you won't retrieve them, I'll get them myself."
"If I'd known you wanted them," said Glinda, trying to make things all right, "I'd have saved them for you. But you have to see, Elfie, the shoes couldn't stay here. The ignorant pagan Munchkinlanders, Lurlinists all, once you scratch the skin, they had put too much credit in those silly shoes. I mean, a magic sword I could understand, but shoes? Please. I had to get them out of Munchkinland."
"You are working in collusion with the wizard to render Munchkinland ready for annexation," said the witch. "You have no agenda of charity, Glinda. At least don't fool yourself. Or are you really under some rusty spell of Madame Morrible after all this time?"
"I won't have you snapping at me," said Glinda. The girl has left. She's been on the road for a week now. She headed west. I tell you, she's only a timid child and means no harm. She'd be distressed to know she'd taken something you wanted. There is no power in them for you, Elfie. The witch said, Glinda, if those shoes fall into the hands of the wizard, he'll use them somehow in a maneuver to re-annex Munchkinland. By now they have too much significance to Munchkinlanders. The wizard mustn't have those shoes.
Glinda reached out and touched the witch's elbow. They won't make your father love you any better, she said. The witch pulled back. They stood glaring at each other. They had too much common history to come apart over a pair of shoes, yet the shoes were planted between them, a grotesque icon of their differences. Neither one could retreat or move forward. It was silly, and they were stuck, and someone needed to break the spell, but all the witch could do was insist, I want those shoes!
At the memorial service, Glinda and Sir Chuffrey perched in the balcony reserved for dignitaries and ambassadors. The wizard sent a representative, resplendent in his dress reds, with the emerald cross marking quadrants on his chest, a crew of bodyguards at attention all around him. The witch sat below and did not meet Glinda's eyes. Frex wept until he brought on an attack of asthma, and the witch helped him out a side door, where he could catch his breath. After the service, the wizard's emissary approached the witch. He said, You have been invited to an audience with the wizard. He is traveling by special diplomatic immunity via a phoenix to offer his condolences to the family this evening. You will be prepared to meet him at Colwyn Grounds this evening.
He can't come here, said the witch. He wouldn't dare.
Those who now make the decisions think otherwise, said the emissary. Be that as it may, he comes under cover of darkness, and only to speak to you and your family.
My father is not up to receiving the wizard, said the witch. I won't have it.
He will see you then, said the emissary. He insists. He has questions of a diplomatic nature to put to you. But you are not to make this visit public, or it could go very hard on your father and your brother. And on you, he added, as if that were not already evident. She considered how she might use this command audience to her own advantage. Serima, the safety of Frex, the fate of Fiero.
I agree, she concluded. I will meet him.
And despite herself, she was glad for a moment that Nessarosa's magicked shoes were safely out of the vicinity. As the vesper bells rang, the witch was summoned from her room by a Munchkinlander maid. You will have to submit to a search, said the wizard's emissary, meeting her in an antechamber. You must understand the protocol here. She concentrated on her fury as she was probed and prodded by the officers who ringed the waiting area. What is this? They said, when they found the page of the grimoire in her pocket.
Oh, that, she said, thinking fast. His Highness will want to see that.
You can bring nothing in with you, they told her, and they took the page from her.
By my bloodlines, I can reinstate the office of the eminent Throp tonight and have your leader arrested, she called after them. Do not tell me what I can and cannot do in this house.
They paid her no mind and ushered her into a small chamber, bare but for a couple of upholstered chairs set upon a flowery carpet. Along the baseboards, dust mice rolled in the draft.
His Highness, the Emperor Wizard of Oz, said an attendant and withdrew.
For a minute the witch sat alone. Then the wizard walked into the room. He was without disguise, a plain-looking older man wearing a high-collared shirt and a greatcoat, with a watch and fob hanging from a waistcoat pocket. His head was pink and mottled, and tufts of hair stuck out above his ears. He mopped his brow with a handkerchief and sat down, motioning the witch to sit too. She did not sit. "How do you do?" he said. "What do you want with me?" she answered. "There are two things," he said. "There is what I had come here to say to you, and then there is the matter of what you bring to my attention." "You talk to me," she said, "for I have nothing to say to you." "There is no point in beating around the bush," he said. "I would like to know your intentions about your position as the last eminence." "Had I any intention," she said, "it would be none of your business." "Ah, alas, it is my business, for reunification is under way," said the wizard, "even as we speak. I understand that Lady Glinda, bless her well-meaning foolishness, has sensibly evacuated both the unfortunate girl and the totemic shoes from the district, which should make annexation less troublesome. I should like to have those shoes in my possession, to prevent their giving you ideas. So, you see, I need to know your intentions in the matter. You were not, I take it, in warm sympathy with your sister's style of religious tyranny, but I hope you do not intend to set up shop here. If you do, we must strike a little bargain, something I was never able to do with your sister." "There is little for me here," said the witch, "and I am not suited to govern anyone, not even myself, it seems." "Besides, there's the small matter of the army at, is it Red Windmill, the town below Kiamo Co?" "So that's why they've been there all these years," said the witch. "To keep you in check," he said. "An expense, but there you are." "To spite you, I should reclaim the title of eminence," said the witch. "But I care little for these foolish people. What the Munchkinlanders do now is of no interest to me, as long as my father is left unharmed. If that is all..." "There is the other matter," he said. His manner became more lively. "You brought a page with you. I wonder where you got it." "That is mine, and your people have no right to it." "What I want is to know where you got it, and where I can find the rest." "What will you give me if I tell you?"
"What could you want from me?" This was why she had agreed to meet him. She drew a deep breath and said,
"To know if Sarima, Dowager Princess of the Arjikis, is still alive, and where I might find her, and how I might negotiate her freedom."
The wizard smiled. "How all things work together. Now, isn't it interesting that I could guess of your concern?" He waved a hand. Unseen attendants outside the open door ushered in a dwarf in clean white trousers and tunic. No, it wasn't a dwarf, she saw. It was a young woman crouching. Chains sewn into the collar of her tunic ran through her clothes to her ankles, keeping her bent over. The chains were only 2 or 3 feet long. The witch had to peer to see for sure that it was Nor. She would be 16 by now, or 17, the age that Elfie had been when she went up to Crage Hall at Shiz.
"Nor," said the witch. "Nor, are you there?"
Nor's knees were filthy, and her fingers curled around the links of her bondage. Her hair was cut short, and welts were visible beneath the patchy tresses. She tossed her head as if listening to music, but she would not shift her gaze toward Elphaba.
"Nor, it's Auntie Witch. I've come to bargain for your release at last," said the witch, improvising.
But the wizard motioned the unseen attendants to usher Nor out of sight. "I'm afraid that is not possible," he said. "She is my protection from you, you see."
"The others," said the witch, "I must know." "Everything is undocumented," said the wizard, "but I believe Sarima and her sisters are all dead." The witch's breath caught in her chest, the last hopes of forgiveness gone. But the wizard was continuing. "Perhaps some underling who had no authority in the matter had an appetite for a bloodbath. It's so hard to get reliable help in the armed forces."
"Yurji," said the witch, gripping her elbows.
"Now he had to die," said the wizard apologetically. "He was the next in line to be prince, wasn't he?"
"Tell me it was not brutal," said the witch. "Oh, tell me so."
"The paraffin necklace," admitted the wizard. "Well, it was a public affair. A statement needed to be made. There now, against my better judgment, I have told you what you wanted to know. Now it is your turn. Where can I find the book that this page is from?" The wizard took the paper out of his pocket and pressed it out onto his lap. His hands were trembling. He looked at the page. "A spell for the administration of dragons," he said, wonderingly.
"Is that what it is?" she said, surprised. "I could not be sure."
"Of course. You must have a hard time making this out," he said. "You see, it does not come from this world. It comes from my world."
He was mad, obsessed with other worlds, like her father. "You are not telling the truth," said the witch, hoping she was right.
"Oh, what care I for the truth," he said, "but I am truthful as it happens."
"Why would you want that?" said the witch, trying to buy some time, trying to figure out how she could barter for Nora's life. "I don't even know what it is. I don't believe you do either."
"I do," he said. "This is an ancient manuscript of magic generated in a world far away from this one. It was long thought to be merely legendary, or else destroyed in the dark onslaughts of the northern invaders. It had been removed from our world for safety by a wizard more capable than I. It is why I came to Oz in the first place," he continued, almost talking to himself, as old men are prone to do. "Madame Blavatsky located it in a crystal ball, and I made the appropriate sacrifices and arrangements to travel here 40 years ago. I was a young man, full of ardor and failure. I had not intended to rule a country here, but just to find this document and return it to its own world, and to study its secrets there."
"What kind of sacrifices?" she said.
"You do not stint from murder here." "Murder is a word used by the sanctimonious," he said. "It is an expedient expression with which they condemn any courageous action beyond their ken. What I did, what I do, cannot be murder. For coming from another world, I cannot be held accountable to the silly conventions of a naive civilization. I am beyond that lisping, childish recital of wrongs and rights." His eyes did not burn as he spoke. They were sunk behind veils of cold blue detachment. "If I give the grimoire to you, will you go?" she said. "Give me Nor and take your brand of evil and leave us alone at last?"
"I am too old to travel now," he said. "And why should I give up what I have worked for all these years?"
"Because I will use this book and destroy you with it if you don't," she said.
"You cannot read it," he said. "You are of Oz, and you cannot do such a thing."
"I can read more of it than you suspect," she said. "I do not know what it all means. I have seen pages about unleashing the hidden energies of matter. I have seen pages about tampering with the orderly flow of time. I have seen disquisitions about weapons too vile to use, about how to poison water, about how to breed a more docile population. There are diagrams of weapons of torture. Though the drawings and the words seem misty to my eyes, I can continue to learn. I am not too old." "Those are ideas of great interest to our times," he said, though he seemed surprised that she had taken in as much as she had. "Not to me," she said. "You have done enough already. If I give it to you, will you surrender Nor to me?"
"You should not trust my promise," he said, sighing. "Really, my child."
But he continued to stare at the page she had handed over to him. "One might learn how to subjugate a dragon to one's own purposes," he mused, and flipped the page over to read what was on the back. "Please," she said. "I think I have never begged for anything before in my life. But I beg of you, it is not right that you should be here. Assuming for a moment you can sometimes tell the truth, go back to that other world. Go anywhere. Just leave the throne. Leave us alone. Take the book with you. Do with it what you will. Let me accomplish at least this in my life."
"In exchange for my telling you about the kith and kin of your beloved Fiero, you are to tell me where the book is," he reminded her.
"Well, I won't," she answered. "I have revised my offer. Give me Nor, and I will get you the Grimoire. The book is already hidden so deeply that you will never find it. You have not the skill." She hoped she was being persuasive.
He stood and pocketed the page. "I shall not have you executed," he said, "at least not at this audience. I will have that book, for here or for there. You cannot bind me to a promise. I am beyond being bound by words. I will think of what you have said, but meanwhile I will keep my young slave girl at my side, for she is my defense against your anger."
"Give her to me," said the witch. "Now, now, now! Act like a man, not like a mountebank. Give her to me, and I will send you that book."
"It is for others to bargain," said the wizard.
Rather than sounding offended, he seemed merely depressed, as if he were talking to himself instead of to her.
"I do not bargain, but I do think. I will wait and see how the reunification with Munchkinland goes, and if you do not interfere, I may be kindly disposed to think about what you have said, but I do not bargain."
The witch breathed in deeply. "I have met you before, you know," she said. "You once granted me an interview in the throne room when I was a schoolgirl from Shiz."
"Is that so?" he said. "Oh, of course. You must have been one of the darling girls of Madame Morrible, that wonderful aid and helpmeet. In her dotage now, but in her heyday, what she taught me about breaking the spirits of willful young girls. No doubt, like the rest, you were taken with her."
"She tried to recruit me to serve some master. Was it you?"
"Who can say? We were always hatching some plot or other. She was good fun. She would never be as crude as that."
He pointed to the open door, through which crouching Nor could still be seen, humming to herself.
"She could manage girl students with much greater finesse."
He was about to leave the room, but he turned back at the door.
"You know, now I remember. It was she who warned me about you. She told me you had betrayed her. You had rejected her offers. She was the one who advised me to have you watched. It is because of her that we found out about your little romance with the diamond-skinned prince."
"No!"
"So you met me before. I had forgotten.
In what form did I appear?"
She had to clutch herself to keep from vomiting.
"You were a skeleton with lighted bones, dancing in a storm."
"Oh, yes, that was clever, that was. Were you impressed?"
"Sir," she said, "I think you are a very bad wizard."
"And you," he answered, stung, "are only a caricature of a witch."
Wait, she called, as he headed away through the panel. Wait, please. How will I receive your answer?
I will send a messenger to you before the year is out, he said.
The panel slammed tightly behind him. She fell to her knees, her forehead dropping almost to the floor. At her sides, her fists clenched. She had no intention of surrendering the Grimmery to such a monster, ever. If need be, she would die to keep it out of his hands. But could she arrange a deception so that he would surrender Nor to her first? She left a few days later, first making sure that her father was not to be turned out of his room in Colwyn grounds. He did not want to join her in the Vincas. He was too old to make the journey. Besides, he thought that Shell would come back sooner or later looking for him. The witch knew that Frex wouldn't live long, grieving so for Nessa Rose. She tried to put away her anger at him when she said goodbye for what she suspected was the last time. As she strode through the forecourt of Colwyn grounds, she crossed paths once again with Glinda. But both women averted their eyes and hurried their feet along their opposing ways. For the witch, the sky was a huge boulder pressing down on her. For Glinda, it was much the same. But Glinda wheeled about and cried out, "Oh, Elfie!" The witch did not turn. They never saw each other again. She knew that she couldn't afford the time to mount a full-scale chase against this Dorothy. Glinda ought to be hiring accomplices to track those shoes down. It was the least she could do with her money and her connections. Still, the witch stopped here and there along the yellow brick road and asked those taking an afternoon tipple at a roadside public house if they had seen a foreign girl in blue and white checks walking with a small dog. There was some animated discussion as the patrons of the pub struggled to decide whether the green witch intended the child harm. Apparently the child had that rare skill of enchanting strangers. But when they had satisfied themselves that no harm was likely, they responded. Dorothy had come through a few days ago, and it was said that she had spent the night with someone a mile or two down the road before continuing on. "The well-kept house with the yellow-domed roof," they said, "and the minaret chimney. You can't miss it." The witch found it, and she found Bock on a bench in the yard, dandling a baby on his knee. "You," he said. "I know why you're here. Milla, look who's here. Come quickly. It's Miss Elphaba from Craig Hall, in the flesh." Milla came, a couple of naked children clutching her apron strings. Flushed from laundry, she lifted her straggling hair out of her eyes and said, "Oh, my, and we forgot to dress in our finery today. Look who's come to laugh at us in our rustic state." "Isn't she something?" said Bock fondly. Milla had kept her figure, though there were four or five offspring in evidence, and no doubt more out of sight. Bock had gone barrel-chested, and his fine spiky hair had grown prematurely silver, giving him a dignity he had never had as an undergraduate. "We heard about your sister's death, Elfie," he said, "and we sent our condolences to your father. We didn't know where you were. We heard you had come here following Nessie's ascension to governor of Munchkinland, but we didn't know where you went back to when you left. It's good to see you again." The sourness that she had felt over Glinda's betrayal was ameliorated by Bock's common courtesy and direct speech. She had always liked him for his passion and for his sense. "You are a sight, you are," she said. "Rickla, get up off that stool and let our guest have a seat," said Milla to one of the children.
and Yellow Gage, run to Uncle's and borrow some rice and onions and yogurt. Hurry now, so I can start a meal."
"I won't be staying, Miller. I'm in a hurry," said the witch. "Yellow Gage, don't bother. I'd love to spend some time and catch up on all your news, but I'm trying to locate this girl stranger who passed by here, someone said, and stayed a night or two."
Bach shoved his hands in his pockets.
"Well, she did that, Elfie. What do you want with her?"
"I want my sister's shoes. They belong to me."
Bach seemed as surprised as Glinda had.
"You weren't ever into fancy trappings like society shoes," he said.
"Yes, well, perhaps I'm about to make my belated debut in Emerald City society at last, and having a coming-out ball."
But she was being tart with Bach, and didn't want that.
"It's a personal matter, Bach. I want the shoes. My father made them, and they're mine now, and Glinda gave them to this girl without my permission. And woe betide Munchkinland if they fall into the wizard's hands. What is she like, this Dorothy?"
"We adored her," he said.
"Plain and straightforward as mustard seed. She shouldn't have any problems, although it's a long walk for a child from here to the Emerald City. But all who see her are bound to help her, I'd say. We sat up till the moon rose, chatting about her home and Oz, and what she might expect on the road. She hasn't traveled widely before this."
"How charming," said the witch. "How novel for her."
"Are you brewing one of your campaigns?" said Miller suddenly, cannily. "You know, Elfie, when you didn't come back from the Emerald City with Glinda that time, everyone said you'd gone mad and had become an assassin."
"People always did talk like that, didn't they? That's why I call myself a witch now, the Wicked Witch of the West, if you want the full glory of it. As long as people are going to call you a lunatic anyway, why not get the benefit of it? It liberates you from convention."
"You're not wicked," said Bach.
"How do you know? It's been so long," said the witch,
but she smiled at him.
Bach returned the smile warmly.
"Glinda used her glitter beads, and you used your exotic looks and background. But weren't you just doing the same thing, trying to maximize what you had in order to get what you wanted? People who claim that they're evil are usually no worse than the rest of us." He sighed. "It's people who claim that they're good, or anyway better than the rest of us, that you have to be wary of."
"Like Nessa Rose," said Miller, meanly. But she was telling the truth, too, and they all nodded. The witch took one of Bach's children on her knee and clucked at it absent-mindedly. She liked children no more than she ever had, but years of dealing with monkeys had given her an insight into the infant mentality she had never grasped before. The baby cooed and wet itself with pleasure. The witch handed it back quickly before the wet could soak through her skirt.
"Regardless of the shoes," said the witch, "do you think a child like that should be sent unarmed straight into the jaws of the wizard? Has she been told what a monster he is?"
Bach looked uncomfortable.
"Well, Elfie, I don't like speaking ill of the wizard. I'm afraid there are too many pitchers with big ears in this community, and you never know who is on what side. Between you and me, I hope Nessa's death will result in some sort of a sensible government. But if we are overrun with an invading army in 2 months, I wouldn't want it bruited about that I'd been bad-mouthing the invaders. And there are rumors of reunification."
"Oh, don't tell me you're hoping for that," she said. "Not you, too."
"I'm not hoping for anything except for peace and quiet," he said. "I have enough trouble getting crops out of these rocky fields. That's what I was in Shiz to learn, do you remember? Agriculture. I've put the best of my efforts into our small holdings, and we only manage to eke out a living."
But he looked rather proud about it, and so did Miller.
"And I guess you have a couple of cows in your barn," said the witch.
"Oh, you're testy. Of course we don't.
Do you think I could forget what we worked for? You and Crope and Tibbet and I? It was the high point of a very quiet life.
You didn't have to have a quiet life, Bok, said the witch.
Don't be superior. I didn't say I was sorry for it, neither the excitement of a righteous campaign, nor the relief of a family and a farm. Did we ever do any good back then?
If nothing else, said the witch, we helped Dr. Dillamond. He was very much alone in his work, you know, and the philosophical basis for the resistance grew out of his pioneering hypotheses. His findings outlived him. They still do.
She did not mention her own experiments with the winged monkeys.
Her practical applications were directly derived from Dr. Dillamond's theories.
We had no idea we were at the end of a golden age, Bok said, sighing.
When's the last time you saw an animal in the professions?
Ah, don't get me started, the witch said. She couldn't stay seated.
Do you remember you hoarded those notes of Dillamond's? You never really let me know what they were all about. Did you make any use of them?
I learned enough from his research to keep questioning, said the witch, but she felt bombastic and wanted to stop talking.
It made her feel too sad, too desperate. Miller saw this and with a brusque charity declared, "Those times are over and gone, and good riddance to them, too. We were hopelessly high-spirited. Now we're the thick-waisted generation, dragging along our children behind us and carrying our parents on our backs. And we're in charge, while the figures who used to command our respect are wasting away."
"The wizard doesn't," said the witch.
"Well, Madame Morrible does," said Miller. "Or so Shen Shen told me in her last letter."
"Oh," said the witch.
"Yes, that's right," said Bok, "though from her bed of pain, Madame Morrible continues to advise our Emperor Wizard on policy matters about education. I'm surprised that Glinda didn't send Dorothy to Shiz to study with Madame Morrible. Instead, she directed her to the Emerald City."
The witch could not picture Dorothy, but for a moment she saw the stooped figure of Noor. She saw a crowd of girls like Noor, in chains and yokes, drifting around Madame Morrible, the way those schoolgirls had all those years ago.
"Elfie, sit down again. You don't look so well," said Bok. "This is a hard time for you. You didn't get along well with Nessa Rose, I seem to remember."
But the witch didn't want to think of her sister.
"It's a rather ugly name, Dorothy," she said. "Don't you think?" She sat back down heavily, and Bok relaxed on a stool a few feet away.
"I don't know," he said. "Actually, we had a chat about it. She said that the king of her homeland was a man named Theodore. Her teacher explained that the name meant gift of God, and that this was a sign that he was ordained to be king or prime minister. Dorothy remarked that Dorothy was a sort of backward Theodore, but the teacher looked it up and said no. Dorothy meant goddess of gifts."
"Well, I know what she can give me," said the witch. "She can give me my shoes."
"Are you trying to say that you think she was a gift of God, or that she is some sort of queen or goddess? Bok, you used not to go in for superstition."
"I'm not saying anything of the sort. I'm having a conversation on word derivations," he answered calmly.
"Let others more enlightened than I ferret out the hidden meanings of life, but I do think it interesting that her name so resembles the name of her king."
Miller said, "Well, I think she's a holy little girl, ordinary and sanctified, just as any child is, no more, no less. Yellow Gage, get your paws off that lemon tart. I can see you from here, or I'll whip you from now to eternity."
The Dorothy child reminded me of what Ozma might have been like, or might yet be like, if she ever comes out of the deep sleep she's supposed to be enchanted into.
"She sounds like a little fright," said the witch.
Ozma, Dorothy, all this talk about save your children. I have always detested it.
You know what it is, said Bok, thinking carefully. Since we're talking about the old days, it comes back to me. I wonder if you remember that medieval painting I once found in the library at Three Queens, the one with the female figure cradling the beast. There was a sort of tenderness and awfulness in that painting. Well, there's something in Dorothy that reminds me of that unnamed figure. You might even call it the unnamed goddess. Is that sacrilegious or what? Dorothy has this sweet charity toward her dog, a pretty dreadful little beast. And Whiffy, you wouldn't believe how repugnant. Once she swooped the dog up in her arms and bent over it, crooning to it, in just the same pose as that medieval figure. Dorothy is a child, but she has a heaviness of bearing like an adult, and a gravity you don't often find in the young. It's very becoming. Elfie, I was charmed by her, to tell you the truth.
He cracked a couple of walnuts and eastern macarons and passed them around.
I am sure you will be, too.
I would like to avoid her at all costs at the sound of it, said the witch. The last thing I'm in a mood for these days is to be charmed by juvenile purity. But I insist on recovering my property.
The shoes are very magic, are they? Said Miller. Or is it just symbolic?
How do I even know? Said the witch. I haven't ever put them on. But if I could get them and they could walk me out of this parlous life, I wouldn't be sorry.
Anyway, everyone blamed the shoes for Nessa's tyranny. I think it's good of Glinda to have gotten them out of Munchkin Land. The child is smuggling them abroad without even knowing it.
Glinda has sent the girl to the Emerald City, said the witch pointedly. If the wizard gets hold of them, it'll be a license to march into Munchkin Land, and you're fools to sit on the fence as if it makes no difference whether he does or not.
You'll stay for something, at least some tea, said Miller soothingly. Look, I've had Clorinda make a fresh pot, and we've saffron cream. Remember the saffron cream party after Amma Clutch's funeral?
The witch breathed heavily for a moment. There was a pain in her esophagus. She did not like to remember those trying times, and Glinda had known full well that Madame Morrible was behind the death of Amma Clutch. Now, as Lady Glinda, she was part of the same ruling class. It was hideous. And Dorothy, whatever her origins, was still only a child, and they were using her to help rid Munchkinland of those damned totemic shoes— or to get the shoes to the wizard, just as Madame Morrible had used her students as adepts.
"I can't stop here chattering like an idiot," she cried, startling them, spilling the bowl of nuts to the ground. "Didn't we waste enough time talking ourselves to death in school?" She grabbed for her broom and her hat.
Bok looked startled and almost fell backward off his seat.
"Well, Elfie, why are you taking offense?" She was beyond answering. She whirled in a small cyclone of black skirts and scarves and ran out to the road. She hurried on foot along the yellow brick road, hardly realizing that a plan was forming in her mind. But she was thinking so hard that for a while she completely forgot she was carrying her broom. And it was only when she paused to rest and lean on it that she remembered it. Bok, Glinda, even her father Frex, how disappointing they all seemed now. Had these folks deteriorated in virtue since their youth, or had she been too naive then to see them for what they were? She felt disgusted with people and longed to be home. She was too out of sorts to seek lodging in an inn or a public house. It was warm enough to stay outside and rest. She lay awake at the edge of a field of barley. The moon rose, huge as it sometimes is when first breaking over the horizon. It backlit a stake with a crossbar, standing as if awaiting a body to crucify, or a scarecrow to hang. Why hadn't she joined forces with Nessa Rose
and raised armies against the wizard. Old family resentments had gotten in the way. Nessa Rose had asked for help in governing Munchkinland, and the witch had denied her request. Instead, the witch had gone back to Kiamo Ko these 7 years. She had squandered the chance to merge forces with her sister. Virtually every campaign she'd set out for herself had ended in failure. She squirmed in the light of the moon, and at midnight, tortured by the thoughts of Nessa's death, the physical fact of being squished like a bug, finally taking on some imaginative shape in the witch's fantasies, she arose and took a new path. Dorothy would no doubt follow the yellow brick road to the Emerald City, and someone as exotic as she could be easily located anywhere along the route. The witch would go and try to accomplish the task set out for herself 15 years ago. Madame Morrible still waited to be killed. Shiz was a money factory now. The colleges, occupying an historic district, remained largely unchanged but for some contemporary dormitories and flashy athletic buildings. Outside the university district, however, Shiz had thrived in the war-alert economy. A huge monument in brass and marble, the Spirit of Empire, dominated what was left of Railway Square, and the air and light around it was cut off by hulking industrial buildings spewing black columns of filth into the air. The bluestone was now grimestone. The air itself seemed warm and earnest, the 10,000 exhalations of a city panting every second to increase its wealth. The trees were shriveled and gray, and not a single animal in sight. Craige Hall looked absurdly older and newer at once. The witch chose not to bother the porter, and flew herself up over the wall into the kitchen garden, where once Bock had tumbled off an adjoining roof almost into her lap. The back lawn beyond the orchard was gone, and in its place stood a stone structure above whose gleaming pockside doors was carved the Sir Chuffrey and Lady Glinda Conservatory of Music and the Theatrical Arts. Three girls came hurrying down the path, chattering away, their books clutched close to their bosoms. They gave the witch a start, as if they were ghosts of Nessa Rose, Glinda, and herself. She had to hold on to her broomstick and steady herself. She had not taken in how far she had come, how much she had aged. "I need to see the head," she said, startling them. But one recovered her youthful aplomb and pointed the way. The head's office was still in Main Hall. "You'll find her in," they said. "She's always in at this hour of the morning, having tea by herself or with contributors." "Security must be greatly relaxed, if none of them questions my being in the kitchen garden," thought the witch. "All the better. I may even escape unstopped." The head had a secretary now, a plump older gentleman with a goatee.
"She's not expecting you," he said. "I'll see if she's free."
He returned and said,
"Madam Head will see you now. Would you like to leave your broom in the umbrella stand?"
"How kind. No thanks," said the witch, and walked through. The head rose from a leather armchair. She wasn't Madame Morrible anymore. She was a small, pinky-white woman with copper-colored curls and an energetic manner. "I didn't catch your name," she said politely. "You're an old girl, but I'm a new one." She laughed at her own witticism, and the witch did not. "And I'm afraid I haven't yet grasped the truth. Dozens of old girls come back every month to relive the pleasant moments of their growing up here. Please, may I have your name, and I'll call for some tea." With some effort, the witch said,
"I was called Miss Elphaba when I was here, more years ago than I realized could be possible. In fact, I won't take tea. I can't stay long. I was misinformed. I was hoping to see Madame Morrible.
Do you know of her whereabouts?"
"Well, is this good luck or is it bad?" said the current head. "Up till very recently, she has spent part of every semester in the Emerald City, consulting with His Highness himself on education policies throughout Loyal Oz. But she's recently returned to her retirement apartment in the Doddery. I'm sorry, that's a joke of the girls and it slipped out. It's called the Daughter Building, really, as it was financed by the generous daughters of Craig Hall, our alums. You see, her health has deteriorated, and, though I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, I fear she is very near the end."
"I'd love to pop in and say hello," said the witch. Play-acting had never suited her, and it was only because the new head was so young, such a fool, such a girl herself, that the witch could get away with it. "I was a great favorite of hers, you know. It would give her a wonderful surprise."
"I'll call Gromatic to take you there," said the head. "But I should ask Madame Morrible's nurse first if she's up to a visit."
"Don't call Gromatic. I can find my own way. I will chat with the nurse, and I will only stop in for a moment. And then I'll come back here before I leave, I promise, and perhaps I can see my way clear to making a contribution toward the annual fund, or some little endowment drive you must be mounting at present." To the best of her recollection, she had never lied before in her life. The Doddery was a broad round tower, like a squat silo, sitting adjacent to the chapel in which Dr. Dillamond had been eulogized. A scout, passing by with buckets and brooms, told the witch that Madame Morrible was one flight up, behind the door with the wizard's standard mounted on it. A minute later, the witch stood looking at the wizard's standard. A balloon with a basket beneath it, commemorating his spectacular arrival in the Emerald City, and crossed swords below. From a few feet away it looked like a huge skull, and the basket a leering jaw, and the crossed swords a forbidding X. The doorknob turned under her tug, and she entered the apartments. There were several rooms, all cluttered with school memorabilia and tokens of esteem from various Emerald City institutions, including the palace of the Emperor. The witch passed through a sort of parlor, with a fire burning in it despite the warmth of the season, and a kitchen scullery area. To one side was a water closet, and the witch could hear the sound of someone sobbing inside, and the blowing of a nose. The witch pushed a dresser against the door, and continued on into a sleeping chamber. Madame Morrible was propped halfway up in a huge bed shaped like a phoenix. A carved gold phoenix neck and head emerged from the headboard, and the sides of the bed simulated the bird's wings. Its feet joined at the footboard. The idea of its tail feathers had apparently defeated the ingenuity of the cabinet maker, for there weren't any. It was a bird in an awkward position, actually, as if being blown backward through the air by gunshot, or as if laboring in a human way to deliver itself of the great mound of flesh sitting on its stomach and reclining against its breast. On the floor was a pile of the financial papers, and an old-fashioned pair of spectacles was set on top of them. But the time for reading was past. Madame Morrible rested in a grey mound, her hands folded upon her belly, and her eyes open and shallow without motion. She was still like a mammoth carp in all but the fishy smell. A candle had been so recently lit that the stink of the match's sulphur still lingered in the room. The witch pulled at her broom. From the other room came a pounding on the door of the water closet.
"Did you think you would always be safe by hiding behind school children?" said the witch, beyond herself, beyond caring, and she raised her broom. But Madame Morrible made a sluggish, indifferent corpse. The witch struck Madame Morrible with the flat of the broom, on the side of the head and the face. It made no mark. Then the witch searched the mantelpiece for the testimonial trophy with the biggest marble base, and she bashed in Madame Morrible's skull with it, with a sound like a splitting of firewood. She left it in the old woman's arms. Its statement could be read by all, except the carved phoenix, who would be looking at it upside down. "In appreciation of everything you have done," it said. The witch had waited 15 years, but her timing was off by 5 minutes. So the temptation to go back and dismember Gromotic was intense. But the witch resisted. She didn't care if she was sentenced and executed for the battery of Madame Morrible's corpse, but she didn't want to be caught because of vengeance against a machine. She took a meal at a café and glanced at the tabloids. Then she wandered into the shopping district. Never one for frippery, she was intensely bored, but she wanted to hear them talking about the death of Madame Morrible. She was waiting for the reviews, as it were, and she would never come back to Chiz, she suspected, nor to any other city. This was her last chance to see loyal Oz in action. As the afternoon wore on, however, she began to worry. What if there was a cover-up? What if the current head, to avoid scandal, hushed up the news of the assault, especially a crime against one so close to the Emperor? The witch began to fret that she would be denied the credit for her deed. She racked her brains for someone to confess to, someone who would be sure to rush to the authorities. What about Crope, or Shenshen, or Fanet? Or, for that matter, the Margrave of Ten Meadows, Nasty Averick? The townhouse of the Margrave was set out in the deer park at the edge of Chiz. It was late afternoon by the time she reached the Emperor's Green, as it was now called. Private residences were dotted about the expanse, each protected by its own security force, high walls lined with broken glass bottles, fierce dogs. The witch had a way with dogs, and high walls didn't bother her. She welcomed herself over the wall onto a terrace, where a maid tending a flox-flower bed had a conniption and resigned on the spot. The witch found Averick in his study, signing some documents with a huge plumed pen, and sipping some honey-colored whiskey in a crystal glass. "I said that I won't come out for cocktails. You're on your own. Can't you listen?" he began, but then he saw who it was. "However did you get in here without being announced?" he said. "I know you, don't I?" "Of course you do, Averick. I'm the green girl of Crage Hall." "Oh, yes. What was your name?"
"My name was Elphaba."
He lit a lamp. The afternoon was darkening, or perhaps clouding over now, and they looked at each other. "Have a seat, then. I suppose if society forces itself in one's study door, one has no further right to deny it. A drink?"
"A wee one."
Alone of them all, he, who had been too handsome to believe, had grown better looking. He wore his hair swept back. It was rich and full, the color of polished nickel. And he clearly had the benefit of a life of exercise and rest, for his figure was strong and slim, his bearing erect, his color good. "Those born with advantages know how to capitalize on them," observed the witch, after her first sip.
"'To what do I owe this honor?' he said, seating himself across from her with a freshened drink in his own hands. "'Or is the whole world playing reprises today?'
"'What do you mean by that?'
"'I had a walk at noon,' he said, "'in the park, with my bodyguards as usual, "'and I came across a carnival entertainment set up there. "'It opens tomorrow, I think, "'and the park will be mobbed with clever students, "'household servants and factory workers, "'and with greasy, gabbling families from Little Glickus.' There were the usual cast of children caught up in the allure of a good circus act, mostly teenage boys helping out, no doubt having run away from tiresome families and small provincial towns. But the guy in charge was a bloody little dwarf.
"'Bloody? How do you mean?' asked the witch.
"'I mean offensive, pardon my slang. We've all seen dwarves before, that's not the point.' It's just that I had seen this very dwarf before. I recognized him from years ago.
Fancy that.
Well, I wouldn't have thought anything more of it, but then you show up this afternoon from more or less the same zone of memory. Weren't you there yourself? Didn't you go with us to the philosophy club that night? We got so drunk, and they had that charmed sex thing, and that effeminate Tibbet got so wasted and lost his mind, and just about everything else, when that tiger... You were there, surely?
I don't think I was.
Weren't you? Bach was, squiggly little Bach, and Fanet, and Fiero, I think, and some others. Don't you remember? There was that hag who called herself Yackle, and the dwarf, and they let us in, and they were so creepy. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's just...
Not Yackle, said the witch. She dropped her drink. This is insanity. My ears are having delusions. Everyone is right. I'm paranoid. No, Averick, I refuse to admit you could remember someone's name for 20 years like that.
She was a balding gypsy woman with a wig and sort of chestnut-colored eyes in thick with this dwarf. I don't know what he was called. Why shouldn't I remember it?
You didn't remember my name.
You didn't scare me half as much. In fact, you never scared me, he laughed. I was probably pretty nasty to you. I was an asshole back then.
You still are.
Well, practice makes perfect, and more than once I've been called a perfect asshole.
I came by to tell you that I killed Madame Morrible today, said the witch. She was so proud of the phrase, it seemed less false when said aloud. Maybe it was true. I killed her. I wanted someone who would be believed to know about it.
Oh, why ever did you do that?
You know, the reasons just reassemble themselves in different patterns every time I think about it. She sat up a little straighter. Because she deserved it.
The avenging angel of justice is now green.
A pretty good disguise, don't you think?
They both grinned.
So about this Madame Morrible, whom you claim to have killed, did you know that she gathered your friends and associates together and gave us a little lecture after you'd run away?
You were never my friend. I was too near to be excused. I remember the situation. Nessa Rose was mortified and shattered by the whole thing. Madame Morrible took out your records and read to us a profile of your character, as assessed by your various teachers. We were warned about your spikiness, your fringiness. What were the words they used? I can't remember that. They weren't memorable words. But we were told you might try to recruit us in some sort of juvenile attempt to galvanize some sort of student uprising. You were to be avoided at all costs.
And Nessa Rose was mortified. Well, that figures.
said the witch grimly. "Glinda, too," said Averick. "She went through another slide, like the one she went into after Dr. Dillamond fell on his magnifying lens."
"Oh, please! Is that hoary old lie still in circulation?"
"Oh, all right. Was brutally murdered by brigands unknown. Have it your way. Brigands in the form of Madame Morrible, that's what you mean me to suppose."
"So why really did you do it?"
"Madame Morrible had a choice. No one was better placed than she to see that her students got an education and not a brainwashing. By hooking up with the Emerald City, she sold out all her students who believed that a liberal education meant learning to think for themselves. Besides, she was a vile fiend, and she did conspire to have Dr. Dillamond murdered, no matter what you say." But the witch stopped herself short, hearing in her words about Madame Morrible, "She had a choice." An echo of what the elephant princess Nastoya had once said to her. "No one controls your destiny. Even at the very worst, there is always choice." Averick was rattling on. "And you've had her murdered. Two wrongs don't make a right, as we boys used to chant on the playground, usually when we were on the ground with someone's knee on our groin. Why don't you stay for a meal? We've got guests, a clever bunch."
"So you can call the police?"
"No, thanks." "I won't call the police. You and I, we're above petulant justice like that." The witch believed him.
"All right," she said.
"Who are you married to, by the way? Did you get married to Fanet or Shen Shen or someone else? I can't remember."
"Whoever," said Averick, pouring another finger of whiskey. "I can't keep small details in my mind, never could."
The Margreaves' pantry was fulsome, his cook a genius, and his wine cellar unparalleled. The guests tucked into snails and garlic, roast crest of fallow hen, with cilantro and clementine chutney, and the witch allowed herself a sumptuous helping of lime tart with saffron cream. The crystal goblets were never empty. The conversation was exalted and loopy, and by the time the Margrievas led them to the comfortable chairs in the drawing-room, the plaster appliqué on the ceiling seemed to swirl like the cigarette smoke.
"Why, you're flushed," said Averick. "You ought to have been a tippler all along, Elphaba."
"I'm not sure red wine agrees with me," she said. "You're in no condition to go anywhere. The maid will do up one of the corner rooms. It's lovely. There's a view clear to the pagoda on the island."
"I don't care for prepared views."
"Don't you want to wait for the morning papers to see if they got it right? If they got it at all?"
"I'll ask you to send me some. No, I must go. I feel the need of some fresh air. Averick, madame, friends, it's been a surprise, and I suppose a pleasure."
But she felt grudging as she said it.
"A pleasure to some," said the Margrievous, who hadn't approved of the conversation. "I think it improper to talk about evil all during a meal. It spoils the digestion."
"Oh, but come," the witch said. "Is it only in youth that we can have the nerve to ask ourselves such serious questions?"
"Well, I stick with my suggestion," said Averick. "Evil isn't doing bad things. It's feeling bad about them afterward. There's no absolute value to behavior. First of all..."
"Institutional inertia," claimed the witch. "But whatever is the great attraction of absolute power, anyway?"
"That's why I say it's merely an affliction of the psyche, like vanity or greed," said a copper magnate. "And we all know vanity and greed can produce some pretty astounding results in human affairs, not all of them reprehensible."
"'It's an absence of good, that's all,' said his paramour, an agony aunt for the Shiz informer. "'The nature of the world is to be calm and enhance and support life, "'and evil is an absence of the inclination of matter to be at peace.'
"'Pig spittle,' said Averick. "'Evil is an early or primitive stage of moral development. "'All children are fiends by nature. "'The criminals among us are only those who didn't progress.
"'I think it's a presence, not an absence,' said an artist. "'Evil's an incarnated character, an incubus or a succubus. "'It's an other. It's not us.' "'Not even me,' said the witch, playing the part more vigorously than she expected. "'A self-confessed murderer?' "'Oh, go on with you,' said the artist. "'We, all of us, show ourselves in our best light. "'That's just normal vanity.'
"'Evil isn't a thing. It's not a person. It's an attribute like beauty. "'It's a power like wind.
"'It's an infection.'
It's metaphysical, essentially, the corruptibility of creation.
Blame it on the unnamed god, then.
But did the unnamed god create evil intentionally, or was it just a mistake in creation?
It's not of air and eternity. Evil isn't. It's of earth. It's physical. A disjointedness between our bodies and our souls. Evil is inanely corporeal, humans causing one another pain, no more, no less. I like pain, if I'm wearing calfskin chaps and have my wrists tied behind me.
No, you're all wrong. Our childhood religion had it right. Evil is moral at its heart, the selection of vice over virtue. You can pretend not to know, you can rationalize, but you know it in your conscience.
Evil is an act, not an appetite. How many haven't wanted to slash the throat of some boor across the dining room table, present company excepted, of course? Everyone has the appetite. If you give in to it, that act, is evil. The appetite is normal.
Oh, no. Evil is repressing that appetite. I never repress any appetite.
I won't have this talk in my drawing room, said the Margrievous, near tears. You've been behaving all night as if an old woman hadn't been slaughtered in her bedclothes. Didn't she have a mother, too? Didn't she have a soul?
Averick yawned and said, You're so tender and naive. When it's not embarrassing, it's quite appealing.
The witch stood up, sat down quickly, and stood up again, aided by her broom.
"'Why did you do it?' asked the hostess, with spirit.
The witch shrugged.
"'For fun? Maybe evil is an art form.'
But as she wobbled toward the door, she said,
"'You know, you're all a pack of fools.' You ought to have turned me in instead of entertaining me all evening.
You entertained us, said Averick broadly, gallantly.
This'll end up being the dinner party of the season. Even if you've been lying all evening about killing this old schoolmarm, what a treat.
The dinner guests drolly applauded her.
The real thing about evil, said the witch at the doorway, "'isn't any of what you said. "'You figure out one side of it, the human side, say, "'and the eternal side goes into shadow, or vice versa. "'It's like the old saw. "'What does a dragon in its shell look like? "'Well, no one can ever tell, "'for as soon as you break the shell to see, "'the dragon is no longer in its shell. "'The real disaster of this inquiry is that it is the nature of evil to be secret.
The moon was up again, a little less swollen than the night before. The witch didn't trust herself to ride on the broom, so she meandered in a zigzaggy way across the greensward. She would find a place to nap outside of the claustrophobia of a society den.
She came upon the construction that Averick had talked about. It was an old, early tick-tock thing, a sort of portable stupa, made of carved wood and figurines, too variegated and numerous for the witch to comprehend tonight. Perhaps there was a running board where she could rest underneath, a platform elevated just a couple of inches off the dampish ground. She peered and moved forward.
"And where do you think you're going?"
A Munchkinlander? No, a dwarf stood in her way. He had a cudgel in one hand and was thwacking it into the thick leathery palm of his other hand.
"Going to sleep when I can," she said. "So you're the dwarf, and this is the thing Averick talked about." "The clock of the time dragon," he said. "Open for business tomorrow night, and not until." "I'll be dead and gone by tomorrow night," she said. "No, you won't," he answered. "Well, gone, anyway."
She looked at it and straightened up. Then something came back to her.
"I wonder how you knew Yackle," she said. "Oh, Yackle," he said. "Who doesn't know Yackle? Not such a surprise."
"Was she killed today?" said the witch. "By any chance?"
"No chance," he answered.
"Who are you?" She was afraid, suddenly, after all this headiness of sorrow and violence.
"Oh, the least significant little one," he said.
"Who do you work for?"
"Who haven't I worked for?" said the dwarf. "The devil is a very big angel, but a very little man. But I have no name in this world, so don't bother with me."
"I'm drunk and disorderly," she said, "and I cannot take any more riddles. I killed someone today. I can kill you, too."
"You didn't kill her. She was already dead," said the dwarf calmly. "And you can't kill me, for I'm immortal. But you try very hard at life, and so I will tell you this. I am the guardian of the book, and I was brought to this dreaded, forsaken land to watch over the book's history, to keep it from getting back to where it comes from. I am not good, I am not bad, but I am locked here, condemned to a deathless life to guard the book. I don't care what happens to you or anyone else, but I protect the book. That is my charge."
The book. She was struggling to understand. She felt drunker the more she heard.
"What you call the Grimmery. It has other names. No matter."
"Then why don't you take it? Why don't you have it?"
"I don't work like that. I am the silent partner. I work through events. I live on the sidelines. I dabble in causes and effects. I watch how the misbegotten creatures of this world live their lives. I interfere only to keep the book safe. To some extent, I can see what's coming, and to that extent, I meddle in the affairs of men and beasts."
He jigged like a little fiend.
"You see me here, you see me there. Having second sight is a great advantage in the security business."
"You work with Yackle?"
"We sometimes have the same intentions, and we sometimes do not. Her interest..."